Chapter 32. High Summer in Sevendore. High Summer was gorgeous in my valley. After Brother Myson's agreement to the ordination of Brother Tevrum, after due examination, one might suspect the God of the Fields had something to do with it. But it helped that Olmeg the Green's wildly successful cropping experiments had, almost uniformly, paid off with a handsome dividend. Already the first fruits of the harvest were appearing in the market, and everyone looked forward to a very, very busy autumn harvest. Since most of the peasantry didn't even know how to harvest some of the new crops, Olmeg was particularly busy instructing them, while two separate crews built new granaries and warehouses in Sevendore village, Gurisham, and even in Genley to contain the surplus. Last winter's lean times looked gone for good. The valley smelled rich and fecund, and from my tower at dawn that morning, I could see across all the way to Matten's Helm. I had enjoyed the cool part of the day so much that after breakfast and a pipe, I had sketched it from my rooftop vantage point, but my scratches on parchment just could not do nature justice. But by noon, the heat had set in and rose a shimmering haze over everything. Only the inconstant breeze was cool enough to keep folk from suffering while they worked, and thankfully the white rocked walls of the pond seemed to suck the heat out of the place like real snow, keeping the water cool. By the time I rode out past the dike tower, however, the heat bore down on us like a hot rain. Even with an opaque disk shadowing me and Traveller the whole way, I felt like stripping off my tunic and riding bare-chested, or better yet, stopping at the pond for a dip and a glance at the naked peasant girls, before heading back to the castle. If Master Olmeg hadn't requested this audience, I would have found a gracious way to bow out. Master Olmeg was always busy, of course, but he took a day off from his other work to show me a project he had been preparing for a while. Now that he had his witchstone, he was eager to learn to use it, and his first big practice piece, he explained, was an enchanted forest. He didn't tell me at first, though, as he wanted it to be a surprise. He just asked to meet me at the dike, so I did. Since our last frustrating encounter ended with a nominal resolution, the Warbird hadn't hired any other mercenaries to plague our frontier, but that didn't mean travellers to Sevendore were safe, nor were my borders secure. My student War Magi had made a career out of learning all of Gimbal's secrets, including where his bandits made their camps. While under the terms of the treaty they should be withdrawn from their pickets, I wasn't going to depend on the strength of a piece of parchment to keep Gimbal's ire from Sevendore. Those bandits would still ply the roads, if I was right. They wouldn't try to rob a large group, of course, or a well-armed one, but a peasant, artisan or foot wizard alone or in small groups was in danger. I'd been having my war magi in training slowly but surely make a detailed analysis of all of Gimbal's castles, across his domains, from the meanest manor house to his own uninspired pile of rocks. Every time I sent one of them on their graduation mission, I'd gotten a wealth of information in return. I could have sent my own men against each of his outposts, but I really had better things to do, and why waste the talent? After several weeks of good spying, good scrying, and good intelligence, I had a better idea of how Gimbal's small realm worked than he did. I rode up to the dike and through the gate. We had a proper wooden gate now, thanks to Tyndall's facility with woodworking magic and some determined carpenters. The smith was working furiously on crafting huge iron hinges for the things, but until then they were held up by a thick knot of leather. It wouldn't withstand a determined assault, but it was better than the wide-open space I'd ridden through last fall. Master Olmeg was already beyond the gate, waiting for me, wearing his light hemp cloth, green robe, and straw hat, a big cowhorn hanging from a baldric from one shoulder, placidly leaning on his staff and smoking his long pipe. I dismounted, let Traveller graze, and warmly greeted my green warden. "So, what commands your attention so greatly, and gives you cause to command mine, Master Olmeg?" I began after an exchange of pleasantries. "Mage Lord, I have undertaken a small side project to contribute to Sevendore's defense," he said simply, in that too-deep voice of his. "You're picking up a mage blade?" I asked in surprise. He frowned. "No, Mage Lord. My strength is not in my arms or in arms at all. Yet there are other ways to defend. Pray, follow me, Mage Lord. Olmec started walking, and with his long legs it only took 2 strides before he was out in front of me. What is that? I asked, pointing to a bunch of new plantings in the fields a few 100 yards beyond bowshot from the wall. I saw it yesterday. Kind of a strange place to plant an orchard. Master Olmec smiled, his big lips splitting his long black beard. Mage Lord, that is intended to be an orchard of doom. More precisely, an enchanted forest, defensive in nature, to discourage the casual interlopers who have been harassing our frontiers. I was intrigued. I had been thinking about local defense in terms of fortifications and fields of fire, entry points and areas of contact, lances and archers, men and spears and bows and gates. But Master Olmec had wisely considered the problem from the enemy's vantage point. Ordinarily, one would want the approach to a strong point cleared of underbrush and trees to deny your attacker places to shoot from cover. One determined sniper with an arbalest or bow could discomfort a patrol for hours. Master Olmec's design gave the illusion of cover, but made every step further through the scrub more dangerous and annoying. He had imported a number of saplings from the south, and there were several new grasses and shrubs newly planted or sprouted, and with Master Olmec's ability to encourage growth, augmented with his sliver of stone, the plants were aggressively taking hold in the foreign soil. Closest to the road are 5 rows of razor grass and hawthorn, mixed every few feet with a fruit sapling known to the wise as Taurine's slick apple, or, more commonly, bloat fruit. They won't be mature for another few weeks, but when these fruits, he said, gesturing with his massive arm, are ripe, they'll look juicy and appealing, the perfect sort of thing for a hungry soldier foraging. The first bite is palatable, but by the time it hits his stomach, it begins to fizz and produce gas until the poor soul is bloated and unable to move. Classy, I said approvingly. And those? I asked, moving a few more rows away from the road. Strangle vines, he chuckled, just a little more viciously than one expects in a botanical mage. They don't actually strangle often, but they entangle effectively, and their sap creates a nasty rash. Oh, and during their flowering period in late autumn, they attract sleep diggers. Any snipers sitting out here for more than a few hours are going to regret it. Those larger saplings, the furthest away, are wave boughs. They're a deciduous evergreen variety from Gilmora. Lovely tree. They don't do anything directly, but they are very sensitive, and if you should chance to trip on one of their delicate widespread roots, it pulls through the tree and shakes the boughs, rotating them just enough to turn them from green to grey. The Gilmorans use them to ring their piggeries to keep track of any strays, but I always thought they'd be ideal for something like this. At the base, I've planted blackberry bushes, also popular with the sleep diggers. And over there, those long, thin, grey trees, those are going to be the eventual home to a number of truly nasty and frightening beasties, he grinned gently. I've got them heavily enchanted for growth, watering them 2 times a day and ensuring proper fertilizer. By this time next year, they could be 1 foot thick, and those are gallows oaks. Are you familiar? I shook my head, mystified. They certainly look like something you'd hang someone from. By design, he agreed, lighting his pipe. They were bred in the late Magiocracy in southern Merwin, among the great magi of the day. They would plant them in the center of a village they owned to dominate the peasants. It had plenty of good strong boughs for hangings, of course, but that wasn't the primary purpose. The gallows oaks take certain kinds of enchantments very well, even while they're alive. In particular, if one knows the art, one can inscribe faces on them, implant them with the proper artifacts, and thereby eventually see and hear what happens in proximity of the trees, particularly in conjunction with sympathy stones, a useful tool of espionage, he reflected thoughtfully. And they have other uses, too. Carrion birds and birds of prey delight in nesting in their boughs. Several types of arachnids and insects prefer its loamy roots. Scavenger beasts of all sorts congregate nearby to clean away the offal. If one wanted a proper gibbet, these would suffice. I had always been squeamish of such displays myself, but that was before I was a mage lord, trying to rule my own domain. "This is an amazing idea, Master Olmec," I said, nodding. "Once more, you not only have not failed me, you have surpassed my expectations. How long until your enchanted forest is deadly?" "I wanted to hurry that along," he admitted. "Some of these varietals won't be ready for a few years, even with growth enchantments and plenty of water. So to add a few more immediate obstacles, I gave our future snipers good, secure places to hide behind." "That's rarely considered a strategic advantage," I observed doubtfully. "I had 5 boulders set up in perfect position, just outside of normal bowshot," he explained, "with good solid cover in front of them. Just a place where you would want to set up a good place from which to shoot at people. But once they get settled in, a few things happen. Suddenly, the dry ground under them isn't very, and the soft and comfy foliage they're hiding within will start to itch. Poisons, ivy, and oak. That won't be an issue for a few hours, of course, but most snipers like to sit around a while before they start shooting." "That still allows them to start shooting," I pointed out, figuring the distance from where we were in the field to the wall. "Not for long," Olmec said smugly. "Each of these safe hideouts are actually very well known to our archers by now. Each boulder is equipped with an enchantment to draw arrows like flowers and encourage bees. Any idiot stupid enough to stay here for more than one shot is going to get peppered. Watch," he said, raising his big horn to his lips and blowing 2 distinct notes. "Here," he said, his big hand pushing me back about 3 feet without the slightest effort. "Watch," he repeated. In moments, a flight of 6 arrows landed within a hand-breadth of each other behind the stone fortification, puncturing any fictitious archer thoroughly. "But I thought we were out of bowshot," I asked. "Of those local bows, surely. But your Bovari are using those heavy Wilderland bows. They have another 40 or 50 feet of range when fired properly, and with a bit of enchantment, we can hit each of these advanced spots quite nicely." He went on to explain plans for importing some more exotic flora and fauna, showed where he had the lads put together some booby traps, future defences he'd like to add, once the forest was well established, that sort of thing. I was tickled by the prospect, and expressed my pleasure at his foresight and vision. "I've been in real enchanted forests. That's pretty much the definition of any place the tree folk live. But growing one from scratch as a means of discouraging unfriendly neighbours made me pleased beyond reckoning. Magic in the service of the people. Just the sort of thing I was trying to encourage. The fact that it would make Gimbal's life more difficult was a pleasant bonus. The future enchanted forest ran along both sides of the road for nearly 1/2 mile. Deep into what was, technically, West Flarian land. It spread back from the road about 100 yards, and I could see how, eventually, it would provide an effective deterrent to interlopers long before they got within bowshot. I gave Master Olmec a bonus of 1 ounce of gold on the spot. The Green Warden was paid a salary, and was entitled to eat from the castle kitchens on demand, but work like this deserved instant praise and reward. As I was riding back toward the castle, after stopping at Bovol Hall and having lunch with Brother Myson and his new pupil, just past Gurisham, I came across young Gareth, trudging along the road like any peasant, only instead of a hoe or shovel, he was bearing a long pole, to the end of which was tied a thin glass rod, about 9 inches long, a sastivator. He saw me and stopped to hail me as I rode by.
"Ho, Mage Lord," he called in his wheezy voice.
I reined to a stop. I hadn't spoken much to Gareth since he had failed my test for a witchstone. I had been busy, and he had continued his studies under the other magi in the Vale. He didn't seem to resent his failure. Indeed, I think he was relieved he would not be trying himself against the goblin onslaught. I doubted he could try himself against an onslaught of kittens. Gareth had no illusions about his physical capabilities, but then he had none about his magical ones either, which were profound. Better, although young, he was turning into a crackerjack thaumaturge. The sastivator was an indication of that. "So, what are you off to, Gareth?" I asked, as Traveller came to a stop.
"I am taking readings, Mage Lord," he replied proudly. At Sir Ondal's suggestion, I have been taking daily readings of etheric density in specific sites, and recording them.
I nodded. That was extremely foresightful of my apprentice, although I would have expected him to conduct the research himself.
And what have you discovered? That the preternaturally low etheric density in Western Sevendor is indeed the lowest recorded anywhere in history.
Really? I asked. I mean, I'd guessed as much, but...
No, Mage Lord, it really is that low. For all practical purposes, there has been a steady, extremely low density here since Yule. That's important,
he reminded me, because so many spells depend on, or are limited by, the local etheric density.
An area this big, with a density this low, is unique,
he said confidently. So, how did I do it? I asked the young mage. He looked at me, perplexed.
Mage Lord, what do you mean? You were there. If you don't know, then...
I was asking for a theory, I corrected, or at least speculation. Why would the birth of my son make all the silica transform? Your professional opinion, I added. Gareth had graduated from Aelar Academy in Wenshar before he had been sent to me as someone's idea of an experiment. Gareth gave it some thought.
Well, if I had to guess, I would say that the three-way dynamic nature of the birth, combined with the abundance of power available to you, provided the means, and the subconscious fears of a magically sensitive child and a panicked mother, induced the resulting transformation. Think about it, he said,
as casually as if we were students after class.
If the child was sensitive to magic, then the trauma of birth would likely inflate the subconscious desire to flee from the source of the disturbance.
That's why he didn't want to come out, I nodded. But then...
Then you intervened, he agreed. You used the Morath sigil,
he said meaningfully. So, what's so special about the Morath sigil? I asked. Yes, I'm a thaumaturge. No, I do not know all the secrets of the universe.
The Morath sigil,
Gareth lectured informatively, was originally crafted from a similar Alka-Alon cognate spell.
It is a dividing spell, an unbinding, but it isn't as brutish as most others. Indeed, it is among the most subtle, because it seeks to alter reality at the level of the Atomai themselves, not merely hack a thing in twin.
I've just always found it useful for stuck doors or gates, I mused, and thaumaturgy, of course.
So my theory, Mage Lord, is that somehow your baby, your wife and you, all entered into a temporary gestalt, during which the abundance of power and the baby's instinctive reaction to being threatened with a high-density area in which to be born,
he said, taking a breath,
leads me to conclude that the Morath sigil, combined with some element of wild magic from the baby, and the overabundance of power, was able to transform the silica into a substance that, in effect, negates etheric density in any one place. As the Morath sigil is a scalable sigil, and there was an exponentially high level of power available, the transformation effect would naturally be wide-scale. Affixing to one of the more abundant, stable, lesser elements like silica would be a good way to saturate the area with a low-density spell. However it is you do that.
Yes. The mechanism is still a mystery, I sighed. But that makes a lot of sense. That's why we use thaumaturgical glass. Because of its stability and enchantability. And might explain one or two other mysteries that night. So what made you start to take readings with the Sastavator?
Just some discussion Sir Ondal and I have been having, he said proudly. We got to talking about the portability issue, the ability to tote around a low magic resistance wherever you go, or wherever you cast a spell, and I got to being curious about just how dramatic the drop-off rate is, so I figured some tests were in order. My notebook is available for the Mage Lord's study,
he added. I might like to see it, I agreed. I am thinking that this snowstone may be almost as valuable as Irionite.
It certainly makes it easier to do magic,
Gareth agreed enthusiastically.
And the Sastivirta's reading on even a very small piece shows a profound change. A pebble no larger than 10 grams reduces the local field to just above nothing. That effect dies in an inverse square. But for a long-term spell, a pebble of snowstone could increase its efficiency by, well, there's no telling how much.
Good work, Gareth. I smiled. I worried you would be bored, merely hanging around Sevendor, waiting for opportunity.
My father always said, smart people never get bored.
The young maid said,
I find the veil fascinating, actually. And the snowstone provides a unique opportunity for study. The ability to learn from both hedge magi like Master Zagor and accomplished specialists like Spellwarden Bannermore and Greenwarden Olmeg make it very worthwhile. I like it here,
he said simply. I like having you too, I said. Keep up the study of the stone. There's no telling how we may be able to employ it, but I would like to know all of its uses if I can discover them.
Well, Mage Lord, one thing I can assure you of,
he said, scratching his head,
is that the snowfall area will be attracting all manner of creature that depends on magic in various ways.
He pointed out,
I am no brown mage, but I can name a dozen species off the top of my head that will be attracted to the forests and vales here. And there is always the possibility that the animals who are native to this zone could become changed over time.
Changed?
Areas of low etheric density tend to have the greatest diversity of plant and animal life,
he reported.
Or so the study of Master Inklo of Vor said 300 years ago.
Interesting, I said, nodding. I'm more worried about the diversity of human life. Namely, the number of foot wizards who will find their way here eventually, and what that will do for the folks who live here. That's why I created the Spellwarden office, which Bannermore says you are acting as his deputy within, I added.
Aye, Mage Lord, while Master Bannermore is not the most potent or knowledgeable mage in the world,
Gareth admitted,
he does possess a broad experience that has been instructive in its own right.
That was a very diplomatic answer, Gareth, I smiled. Let's make the appointment official, with a half-silver weekly stipend. And title, of course. You're staying at Bannermore's shop these days?
I have a corner in the warehouse,
he admitted.
I've been sleeping there at night, after I finish up whatever piecework Master Bannermore gives me. I'm also,
he added, almost as an afterthought,
picking up some practical enchanting.
Excellent, lad, I said, flipping him a silver coin for his diligence. I'll make the arrangements with Bannermore. Keep up the good work, I waved to him as I rode back through town toward the castle. He waved, smiled, and shouldered his pole before tromping resolutely over the fields, towards a high spot on an incline he had been taking readings from religiously. I stopped at Bannermore's shop, but he wasn't there, so I found myself at the Oak Tree Tavern, where young Tiernard now had almost 2 walls built around the tree. It was still the middle of the day, and most folk were out in the fields, hoeing weeds out of them or tying them up to stakes. The tavern had less than 6 patrons at this time of day, which gave me plenty of room to take a seat, light my pipe, have a drink of good ale, and admire the young ladies who were bathing naked in the coolness of the pond. The ladies' section of the mill pond was screened from casual observation, and the men's section, by a line of thick bushes. Such obstacles are no match for magic, however. With mage sight, I could contentedly observe the wonders of nature from the comfort of the tavern's open-air taproom. Life was good, here, but the almost daily dispatches from Gilmora were growing increasingly grim. Telamon had established a regional headquarters in Castle Cambrian, north of Barrowbell, and he was dispatching units of 500 or 1,000 lances to chase down larger bands of goblins, but the depredations of the raiders had gotten worse and worse. Where they found castles and fortresses closed against them, they turned their attention on peasants caught in the open. The raiders were actually raiding now, not just burning. When they overcame a manor or a village, they gathered up the foodstuffs and weapons and then led the survivors north into the wilderlands, after, according to accounts, eating their beloved dead in front of them. There were plenty of success stories of knights and men-at-arms coming to the rescue of distant towers and manors, and rescuing folks from their attackers, but that hadn't stopped hundreds of villages and hamlets in Gilmora from being savaged, and in the middle of the growing season, too. I sat and thought about the war, as I had been doing all too frequently recently, and I sipped my ale and was thankful I wasn't there, even as I felt guilty. I would have to return to it some day, else it would find me here in Sevendor. But here and now, the sun sparkled off of the white-bottomed pond and the white-bottomed girls, and the air was warm and the scent of blossoms overwhelming. I thought about the enchanted forest, and the other one on the boundaries of the Westwood that Master Olmec wanted to grow. I thought of the bother of leaving my golden little valley again soon, for the rare chance to see a king crowned. Duke Rard's coronation, due to happen in conjunction with the Coronet Council, was to happen around the solstice, and that was only a few weeks away. I'd have to travel again, and I'd have to bring another large retinue, but I might be able to secure things at the duchy's capital that I couldn't in Sandaria, such as a real noble's seal. But in the meantime, I planned on relaxing, eating summer berries, playing with the baby, loving my wife, drinking a lot of ale, and enjoying life. Without guilt, I reminded myself, I had earned this peace. A sparkle in the distance made me sit up and take notice, and using mage sight, I found the spot on the ridgeline where young Gareth must be using his sastivator. I admired his dedication to the science of magic, the way he'd dutifully noted in his records the exact reading at the exact time of day. Then I discovered that, from that particular spot, a mage with mage sight has a completely and utterly unobstructed view of the women's bathing area below, something which Gareth apparently had discovered early on, and had diligently reported from every day. Such dedication, I smirked. But why not? It was high summer in Sevendor, and if it was too hot to wear much clothes, then it was too hot to go to all the bother of averting your eyes. As I swept back to take another glance at the flowers of Sevendor's maidenhood, I noted that they themselves were staring unabashedly and with decided interest at the sight of the new mill, where shirtless and nearly pantsless young masons were building the foundations. It looked like everyone was feeling the heat of high summer.